So, what's left? That's the question we posed to a panel of notable Wisconsin progressives, Ed Garvey, John Nichols, Barbara Lawton, Peg Lautenschlager, and Matt Rothschild. Charlie Uphoff, board member of the Madison Institute, moderates the discussion. This talk was held on April 24, 2015, on the UW-Madison campus and was sponsored by the Madison Institute, a policy study center in the progressive tradition. This talk was recorded during Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker's run for President of the United States. First, we hear from Connie Trinan, former chair of the Madison Institute. Then John Nichols is the first to speak.
The whole idea is to consider the era that most of us have lived through that we thought was good and was only going to get better. And now we're a little disappointed. Things aren't going quite the way we thought. The progressive mission that is the mission of the Madison Institute has been disappointed in things that are happening. And so we wanted I have a chance for a lot of people here to some extent give your own reports on what you think is happening and what should happen.
All right. Well, I will speak with Francis McGovern overlooking me. And I will note that Francis McGovern was a Republican, and then he was a progressive, and then he was a Democrat. And in the best way to understand the Wisconsin tradition is that it has never had anything to do with political parties. In fact, I once had a national political consultant who had moved to Wisconsin, and she said, I got to have lunch with you. I got to ask you a question. Does every other state I've ever been in, when you win the primary, everybody gets together and they say, yeah, let's go do this. Because in Wisconsin, when you have a Democratic primary and somebody wins, then everybody says, well, I'll think about whether I'm going to back you. And that's the bottom line of Wisconsin. It has always had a very independent, very non-party politics. Unfortunately, as our media has collapsed, we no longer have a functioning media system in the United States. And as money, which Matt will talk about, has rushed into our politics, we have ended up in a situation now where we are deeply divided and we live in our silos. We talk to people who generally agree with us and we live in a space where we're rather comfortable. We have become increasingly partisan, all of us. As a result, the old Wisconsin progressive politics makes very little sense in the contemporary era. And we keep trying to recreate something that isn't there anymore. Now, I wish I could tell you it was, because it is a beautiful thing. The fact of the matter is that Wisconsin used to be the biggest ticket splitting state in the country. It was an incredible thing. And this is not ancient history. In 2004, 200,000 people voted for George Bush for president and Russ Feingold for the U.S. Senate. Oh, and you thought, well, what the heck's going on with that, right? Except that then when you went down that ballot, you saw this happen again and again. People would move around. They would follow political figures and political groupings that they were inspired by, that impressed them. That time is over. And the notion that somehow you're going to get people to split their ballots and move around on a ballot is a fantasy. If you want to know how big a fantasy it is, now, is it not to pick on Jim Doyle?
Why not?
Because I know that my governor of Wisconsin, Ed Garvey, will do so in a moment. But Jim Doyle, I'm going to say it bluntly, I don't think was quite as inspired a figure as Russ Feingold. And yet, with this guy's in the crowd, like, well, yes, that's true. And again, it's not to pick on Doyle, it's to say they're very different figures. And Feingold had, you know, all sorts of very inspired, independent votes. He was very much a man who was willing to take on his own party. And he did exactly the right thing. In 2010, when he was preparing to run for re-election in 2009 when the Democratic Party absolutely blew it at the worst possible way by doing fake financial services reform, the Dodd-Frank Act, which did nothing to break up big banks and which set up a system where when the same people that steered us into global economic collapse do it again, they will be bailed out again. When the Democratic Party did that, Russ Feingold voted against it. He actually, you know, and that should have been a big deal. He had voted against Democratic and Republican presidents on trade. He had defended civil liberties, the only vote against the Patriot Act. He had done all these things. And you know what that counted for? Nothing. In 2010, Russ Feingold got almost exactly the same vote that Jim Doyle got. Sorry, 2010, I apologize. Russ Feingold and Tom Barrett got the same vote. My mistake there. But bottom line is, no distinction there in the vote. Now, if they'd nominated Barbara Lawton, of course, they would have had a significantly better vote. Might well have saved Russ Feingold. But this is the thing I want to emphasize to you. All that Feingold did, right, after that period of Doyle being governor for 8 years, I think we had deadened out the sense of distinction between Democrats and Republicans in this state. And frankly, I think that made it very, very easy for Scott Walker to become governor of Wisconsin. Because we had a period where having a Democrat in charge didn't seem to mean all that much to people. Now, and I'm serious, you take a look at it now, it seems like it matters a great deal. But this is the great challenge of what's happened in our politics. People have collapsed into their camps. And getting them out of their camps is not going to come with small solutions, with small answers. The idea that you can get somebody to shift their politics simply by saying, well, I'm a little bit nicer than those guys, or I'm a little bit, you know, more decent than they are on a couple of things, is a comic notion. It isn't going to happen. It is not going to happen. And this is where we get into the great question of our moment. The progressives in Wisconsin came to power because they proposed to rip everything up and do it differently. They did not propose to manage the mess that had been created by the people before them. They did not propose to be soft and gentle governors of the state. What did Robert M. La Follette propose? Amending the Constitution of the United States, amending the Constitution of the United States to create an elected U.S. Senate, not one appointed in backroom deals. Amending the Constitution of the United States to allow for the taxing of corporations and for progressive taxation. Amending the Constitution of the United States to give women the vote so that half of the populace that was not allowed to vote would be allowed to vote. These were all radical proposals. These were transformational proposals. You could not, to give you an idea of how important they were, if you hadn't done the last of those amendments, Mitt Romney would be president of the United States today. Because Barack Obama's never gotten, he didn't get the majority of the men. It was the women that elected him. Changing the Constitution, changing fundamental things, is far more important than whatever issue you're talking about today. I guarantee you that is true. So number one, they proposed radical transformational changes. The 1911 legislature in Wisconsin, they wrote so many new laws, so many new structures, it literally went page after page after page. And do you understand that what they're doing in the legislature right now in Wisconsin is literally, literally going back to 1911 and undoing those laws? This is what they wrote so much in 1911 that Scott Walker, Scott Fitzgerald, Robin Voss, and all of their creativity still haven't caught up to all of it. And so you understand, they did a lot. They proposed to do more. Do you know that Scott Walker actually suggested, Scott Walker's running for president. The guy we should have elected president in 1924, Robert M. La Follette, actually suggested that we ought to term limit the United States Supreme Court and allow for the recall of Supreme Court justices that serve corporations rather than the people. No, but that's right. And now, and I know you're applauding, but if you went to a group of Democratic Party people, said, "Well, we should, you know, a good way to get rid of Citizens United is just get rid of the Supreme Court," right? They would run from the room screaming. They'd say, "Oh, that's a, that's actually trying to change something." So, first off, there is no way you break this partisan siloing by making small proposals. It's as simple as that. And until we break out of that pattern, we don't get anywhere. Second and final thing I'll say to you. The progressives rose in Wisconsin because they actually looked at what was happening technologically. They actually looked at what was happening societally, and they addressed it in context. We have no one in our politics today, in Wisconsin, or frankly, virtually no one nationally, who is addressing the fundamental transformation of our society. You will pick up any magazine and it will tell you that the digital age is a contemporary equivalent of the Industrial Revolution. And it's absolutely true. There's no doubt of it. The digital age has changed every single thing about our lives, right? We don't read a newspaper. We get our information through a telephone, right? Do you know that 10 years ago, YouTube didn't exist? It didn't exist. Today, YouTube gets 4 billion visitors a day. We have transformed virtually everything that we know about how we communicate and about who is in charge of our communications. Digital communication has changed everything about our lives, right? Now, here's the big deal. Nobody is talking about how to democratize that. Nobody is talking about how to do anything that puts we the people in charge of that. The only thing that is being discussed is whether we're going to get an Apple Watch or whether, you know, what new technology is going to come out of Google. And the fact is, we have ceded control over our future to the biggest monopolies since the Gilded Age. These tech companies are huge monopolies. They buy their competitors out. They shut down competition. They seek to define how we communicate. They seek to define structurally almost everything that goes on in our lives. And we have nobody even discussing it. I'll just finish by saying that if you look back at the progressive movement, that's exactly what they were talking about, was humanizing the Industrial Revolution. They're literally talking about hundreds of changes that would make more humane a point in history where you made children work in factories rather than teach them in schools. This is where I think the Wisconsin Democratic Party, and frankly the National Democratic Party, if it's to have a future, has to change radically. And frankly, the left, far beyond the Democratic Party, has to change radically. Because we have enough movements. You take a look at what's out there, Black Lives Matter, amend the Constitution to get money out of politics, the return of the labor movement is something really meaningful. All this is there. We have all these different movements, and yet very little traction. What I would argue is, if we're to get someplace, we have to recognize what's changing people's lives today. The fact that the digital revolution with apps and robots will mean that we will have far fewer jobs in the near future than we have now, and that we also have to make dramatic proposals on how to democratize the future rather than to simply let the monopolists decide what's going to happen to us. I'll close on that because I think that's the core of what, if we frame out, we need to talk about. And why do we, these are national problems, not just Wisconsin problems. But historically, Wisconsin progressives have led the entire nation as a laboratory of democracy. This is the place where the big ideas have come from. And if it doesn't start here, I will guarantee you, it's not going to start. So the fact of the matter is, I'm not worried about Scott Walker this minute. Not worried about Republicans in the legislature this minute. What I'm really worried about is the progressive movement in Wisconsin talking about big enough issues and talking about big enough changes. Thank you.
Ed Garvey, attorney and founder of the annual Fighting Bob Fest.
John Nichols is so much smarter than I am, I have no idea what he's talking about. But I'm so pleased to tell you that all of you can relax because God is talking to our governor, and we're sure, I'm sure it's any problems that go unresolved, he'll be able to solve them by just talking directly to God. And I'm going to try it. Now I know why God hasn't been talking to me. She's been busy dealing with the governor. I will just say, I am so embarrassed to have someone like Scott Walker as a candidate for anything, but the idea for president is so ridiculous, it's hard to deal with it. I mean, you just have to look at it and say, are you kidding me? I mean, we've had a lot of great people in the state of Wisconsin over the years who could have run for president or whatever office they chose, but now we're stuck with this guy. I mean, if we could sum up Scott Walker in one thing, it was his phone call from David Koch. Can you imagine where he's talking and he thinks he's talking to one of the Koch brothers? And one of the Koch brothers, the phone, he says, what about putting some agent provocateurs into the crowd? And he says, we've thought about that. We decided not to do it. Here's the governor of the state of Wisconsin saying you were thinking of dumbing up a way to destroy the movement over there. But at least we now know he faced 100,000 terrorists. I mean, that's why it's so silly. I mean, it's almost impossible to talk about. The one thing I want to say to you is this. I am delighted to see all the people here who I know from various campaigns on this panel. I'm going to learn more than you can hear from me. So I'm delighted that you're here. I'm delighted that we have a chance to talk. And we'll see what goes on with the governor as he goes forward with more of his fairy tales about what goes on in the state of Wisconsin. But let me just say this. We do not have a Democratic Party in the state of Wisconsin. I don't know what we have, but we don't have a Democratic Party. We don't have very many candidates. We don't have any money. And it seems to me we don't have any big ideas. I mean, there was a special on public television, Make No Small Plans. That's really what John Nichols was saying, make no small plans as we're here. Let's talk about throwing out the system as it is right now. Say goodbye to the so-called democracy that we're talking about. And come to grips with the fact that we have to get people involved. And what I'm tired of hearing is, well, don't worry about it. We'll beat them with shoe leather. Because, you know, we don't have any money, so we have to come up with something else. So we say, we're gonna out-manipulate the right wing and all the people they can hire, the Koch brothers, because they have so much money, we can't get any ourselves, or it's certainly not enough to make a difference. So I'm looking for some answers rather than just giving you the answers, because you have a better idea of what we need in the state of Wisconsin than I do. What we need is a commitment, not just to a few minor changes, but to take on the system as it is and just recognize democracy is dead in the state of Wisconsin. We're just kidding ourselves. And I ask you to just think about who's going to run for governor. I mean, it gets so bad in the state of Wisconsin, I ran for governor. And I think it's getting even worse. So think about what we have to do in order to change the way that we're approaching the governed and those of us who are concerned about what's going to happen. We can't continue to pretend that we have a Democratic Party that is going to come up with a candidate with money and defeat whoever the Republicans put up, because the Republicans don't have a party either. What they have are the Koch brothers, and they have a private unlisted number, so they can call and talk to each other every now and then, and once in a while God picks up on the extension. So somehow or other, over the course of the next couple of hours, let's figure out at least a step toward changing things where we can admit that the democracy that we once knew is gone. We've got to come up with something new. If we don't come up with something new, there's no chance of our winning carrying the state of Wisconsin in 2 years or 4 years or 6 years or 8 years. We have to do more. And it's not just saying, let's find a wealthy candidate and support that wealthy candidate, and particularly that if that candidate has enough money to run his or her own campaign. Well, so what if they have enough money? That doesn't mean they have any ideas. And if they don't have any ideas, they may have ideas, they may have everything, but there's no way for them to express it. They can't do it by expecting the Democratic Party to do anything, because the Democratic Party has given up trying to put forward the big picture as we go forward. So I'm going to stop talking and listen.
Barbara Lawton is our next panelist, and I'm sure has a lot of insight and thoughts and good ideas to share with us. So no pressure.
No, none.
It's such a pleasure to be here and to be with so many old friends and good friends and people who are unwilling to just pull the covers over your head in Wisconsin and hope for a better day. But as I was listening to John, I just want to, when we talk about what's left or reflecting on the decline of the Progressive Party, by looking around the room, I can reflect on the opportunity for a progressive movement. We're all a little bit long of tooth. And as we think about the roots of the Wisconsin tradition of progressivism that was really without an attachment to a party, but an attachment to ideas and a vision, I've been doing a lot of work recently and having long conversations with some very ambitious, bold-thinking, deeply patriotic and attached to the idea of a strong democracy, millennials, young people. And they are not, they tend to be, in the great majority, apolitical, nonpartisan, social entrepreneurs, who are just beginning to understand that if those visions and innovative ideas they have to improve the quality of our life and the way that we're living want to be enacted and pushed forward, that they're going to come into a collision with public policy, and they're going to need public policy behind them. And so part of our job is to meet them where they are, and where these ideas are fomenting and this energy and this ambition for us as a state and a nation, and get behind them, just say, what do you need? And empower them, but help them to become politically savvy, because they need to be political entrepreneurs too. And they're hungry to do this. Like us, all of us in this room, they still have an imagination for how a democracy can work. And we do too. But when we think about what John just said about a digitized age and economy and what this means and the impact it's having and the way it's shaping our economy and the business and our lives, they're natives to this. We're immigrants. If the change is going to be smart, impactful, and really hit the target, we are going to have to learn from them. And today I spoke with a young woman who is a real leader in this area who needs to be empowered to lead more, and a young man who's also leading in this area. And there hasn't been a centripetal force to bring these millennial leaders together and have them see how they can work the areas of civic engagement, of networking that isn't just Facebook. They know they have to get out of this, and they have ideas for how to do this that we can't conceive of. So I guess I see, Matt and I have been talking about a paper that was written recently by a very smart thinker about democratic reform that was called Political Opportunity, a new framework for democratic reform. And thinking about now the costs of a cumulative inequality that is driven through by the way our economy and the government that maintains this status quo has been shaped, and it's been shaped by big money that can keep it there and by the two parties that are dependent on that money to be there. The Oxfam America did an interesting paper that was kind of a flip side and maybe the negative side of that notion of political opportunity as a making sure that there is opportunity spread with greater equality, political opportunity through our society, if we're going to really embrace the talent and the vision of the people of this country. The Oxfam called it, the flip side of it, political capture. And that's where we are right now. So for me, we have actually a moment in history that is a perfect replay, we heard all of the parallels that John gave us to 100 years ago and the launch of a really strong progressive movement in Wisconsin. I believe that if we chose to, if we invited millennials in and gave them the opportunities to really work an interesting plan, all of the movements, all of the good work that we've done, all of the labor, existing labor movements, existing reform organizations, the League of Women Voters, we've become a bit moribund. And we haven't found a way to help young people become really meaningfully engaged in the terms by which they live and with the means by which we have now. So I see tremendous opportunity.
You're listening to a panel discussion of notable Wisconsin progressives in What's Left? Reflections on the Decline of the Progressive Party, sponsored by the Madison Institute. Panelists include Ed Garvey, John Nichols, Barbara Lawton, Peg Lautenschlager, and Matt Rothschild, and moderated by Charlie Uphoff, board member of the Madison Institute.
Peg Lautenschlager, Peg is, you all know, has been, as all of us have, around for a while. And
thanks, Charlie.
So, Peg.
For somebody who lives in Fond du Lac, it's really fabulous to see this many progressive faces. And as someone from Fond du Lac, greetings from the other silo. I am a lone ranger there, although not so much so. Barbara and John both touched on something that's very near and dear to me, which is sort of where do we go from here, which is the topic at hand today. But I guess I have had this sort of unique experience. Barbara has to some degree, too. My husband and I together have 5 children, and they range in age from 24 to 36, which makes you all really old because it's the 34-year-old you remember being passed around when he was a baby, but at various political events. But it's interesting to talk with them because they are all very politically aware, and they're very diverse. My older stepson is a sheriff's deputy in Winnebago County. The next one is an attorney here in Madison who works for a firm called Perkins Coie, and right now he's working on the North Carolina voter ID case. He does political law. He used to be a prosecutor and then somehow decided that corporate America pays more, even though he's apparently among the good guys. Then we have a teacher in Lamira, Wisconsin. Then we have a musician who is a mix engineer and works for Jay-Z and Rihanna and people like that, mixing their music, all of which has to do with women with large derrières, which makes me feel, which is apparently a good thing now, which makes us see how generationally challenged we are. And then I have a daughter who's currently working for a Republican car dealership, managing all of their marketing and customer development for 4 dealerships. And she is indeed her mother's child, despite her current profession. That being said, they are different, as you can see, and they all have different interests, and they all come in the world in a different perspective. But the one thing in which they have in common is they all view me as being very, very old. And it isn't just my grandchild, it's my grandchildren. And the reason they view me as very, very old is primarily because of my advocacy for what are the my kind of Vietnam, post-Vietnam generation progressive ideas, which I found to be somewhat different in my own brain of my parents' FDR New Deal kind of progressive values. And they have a set of progressive values that is different. But what we forget when we're looking at that generational change is that this generation, as John pointed out in his Barbara mentioned, with in terms of computerization of everything, in terms of everything being based on binary systems where there's a yes and a no and there's no gray area in between, they come from a generation where yesterday was like a decade ago for us. And as a result of that, their priorities have to do with things that aren't necessarily the same as ours. They do not view the world as, they do not want a world where you can find a good job in, say, a factory and continue to work there and gain in seniority and have your income rise every year based on inflation or whatever, and hopefully get some good benefits and have a retirement. And we presume that that's because they're snobs and they don't want to work in the factory. That isn't it. They live in a society where now they are going to probably have 3 or 6 or 10 jobs.
Or no jobs.
Or no jobs by the time they get to be retirement age, whatever that's going to be when they get older. And so the notions that we have in terms of what needs to be done in order to create a more equal, a more fair, a more caring society are different for them than they are for us. And it plays itself out in all sorts of ways. A year or two ago, there was a poll done about how young people belong to churches less. They're more skeptical, and they don't like the whole group thing. They belong to public service organizations less, the Rotary, the whatever. There are fewer young people who join those kinds of organizations. So it should come as no surprise to us that whether or not you're part of the IWW or the AFL-CIO, or you're part of the Democratic Party or the Green Party or whatever, that younger people don't view themselves as being identified based on groups to which they belong. They identify themselves based more on social media networks they have, and do they check out one blog or another or whatever else. And so for us to take our set of values, which is getting older exponentially quickly, and try to ask of this younger generation, hey, you know, what do you think about this? They look at you like, you know, what planet were you born on? And you know what? The planet we were born on isn't the planet they recognize. And so, I mean, I have a grandson who's 6, and we realized last week that he was born a month after Barack Obama was sworn into the presidency to the day. He was devastated a month ago because he learned that we're going to have a new president. And he said, Barack Obama's the president. And kind of said, well, no, there are elections. And he said, well, that's just to get rid of Scott Walker. And I said, and he thinks there's a good Walker, and the good Walker's first name is Recall. And he's a little upset because Recall didn't run in the last election. But these are the perspectives. And he's a generation after my kids. So I think that as we determine what is going to be where progressive values are going and what they're doing, we need to have this overlay of recognizing that the world in which the millennials live is very, very different from the world in which we live. And I don't think it's that their values aren't progressive. Talk about gay rights, you talk about access to healthcare, you talk about all of those things, and they are there. But the issue is just how do we energize and move them forward in a way that allows for society to politically deal with those issues in a way that's positive so that we aren't dealing with the Scott Walkers of the world all the time.
Matt Rothschild, Director of the Democracy Campaign of Wisconsin.
It's a very strange moment here in Wisconsin. We're in the midst of a counter-revolution, and I think we need to recognize that. It's not just happening here in Wisconsin. It's happening all across the country. Scott Walker isn't the only person carrying that banner, but he's the favorite of the counter-revolutionaries, of the Koch brothers. And it is ironic and terribly sad that Wisconsin, which once was the laboratory of democracy, as John said, is now the laboratory of plutocracy. And we're seeing that every day with the pieces of legislation that are coming down. One of the lessons that I think we need to learn is to be prepared when people get excited. And I think there was a failing of the progressive movement in two recent instances. The first instance was Obama. It's a misnomer to call it a movement. It was a moment. It was a cult of personality in a way. It was a great step forward in race relations for this country to elect the first black president. But there wasn't enough being done to force his hand to the left. And my daughter, as long as we're talking personally, I took her to the Iowa caucuses. She was 18. It was her first election. She was so excited. We thought Edwards was going to win in Iowa, maybe, because he'd been living there for 3 or 4 years. And,
pretty good thing he did.
Yeah. And so we went to Edwards' headquarters, and then we went to Hillary's headquarters, which was very professional but not super exciting. And then we went to Obama's headquarters, which was rocking. This was in Dubuque. You were in Dubuque that day too, John. And then to go to that caucus, which was so sensational to see the Obama energy, and then to have him win and how euphoric that was, I think, for all of us. And yet it was not enough to vest our hopes in one person. And we needed to do more. Then my daughter was terribly now disappointed and alienated in a sense from politics because Obama didn't deliver. And I think a whole mess of young people who went door to door, and she went door to door with my wife, are just terribly disappointed and burnt out. And the other, there are two other instances, really. The one here in Wisconsin was the uprising, the great uprising of 2011, which in my adult lifetime was the most exhilarating experience politically. And it was straight out of a Howard Zinn People's History of the United States, this largely spontaneous uprising that just snowballed and snowballed and snowballed. And yet, we as progressives, and I fault myself personally, did not do enough at that time to try to steer things in the most powerful way. We had 100,000, 110,000 people in the streets surrounding the Capitol, and yet we didn't exercise the latent power that was there. We could have done a lot of innovative things. We could have exercised civil disobedience. For the first time in my political life, I heard the expression general strike in public being uttered and discussed. And South Central Federation of Labor even had a meeting where they discussed whether to go forward with it and did discuss forming a meeting to look into what a general strike would be like. This was a revolutionary moment here, and we let it go. And we're facing the consequences of it now. And that's too bad. I mean, I think we needed to, all of us who call ourselves progressives, needed to say, look, we are not going to leave the Capitol when they want us to get out of the Capitol. And we are going to shut down business as usual. And we didn't do that. We could have done it. I think actually some of the leadership high at the highest ranks of the labor movement and as well at the highest ranks of the Democratic Party didn't know what to do with 100,000 people, were actually scared of 100,000 people in the street because they couldn't control 100,000 people. And so that was a problem. And then I wonder what happened to, in the recall, not of the state senators, but in the recall attempt with Walker, what happened to those million signatures? It's hard to collect signatures. I've passed petitions around back in the day in the anti-apartheid movement on campus. It was hard to get people to sign those things. And so to get a million people to sign petitions was extraordinary. And to have, 10,000 people circulating petitions was extraordinary. What in God's name happened to those petition circulators and petition signers? I don't know. My hunch is that the leadership of the Democratic Party decided, they were going to go a different way. They were going to go the old way. They were going to run ads on TV and get big donors to give them money for ads and do focus groups and do that. It was totally the wrong strategy. They should have thrown all the money at those million people who signed those signatures and the 10,000 people who circulated those petitions and said to all million people, you guys got to all show up and you got to bring all your relatives, including your pothead son who lives in the basement, and get them out to the polls. And that didn't happen. And I have a real good friend, Kevin Alexander Gray, who was head of the ACLU of South Carolina and who's written for the Progressive and gave a great talk at Fighting Bob Fest last summer, and he told me during the recall that you've got to beat them. You have an obligation to the nation and to the progressive movement to defeat this guy, because otherwise there would be hell to pay. And I remember having lunch with Ed Garvey and Dave Zweifel about 6 months before that election, and they were saying the same thing. God, we got to get a candidate, first of all. And we didn't. And so here we have Scott Walker, who, to my calculation, I'm a gambler, has probably got a 50% chance of getting the Republican nomination and maybe a 24% chance of being the next president of the United States. So, that's on our conscience. The other thing is the Occupy movement. Now, this was an interesting movement, and yet there wasn't enough done to steer all that energy into a structure that could continue. And it was interesting for me to read Naomi Klein's This Changes Everything, because in there she has a critique, a subtle critique, but it's there if you read it, of the Occupy movement. And at the time, she was one of the chief proponents of the Occupy movement, and good on her for doing that, because they were getting shot at from all sides, and she needed to support them. But in hindsight, she said, you know, we needed to set something up that could endure with that energy, and that didn't happen either. So the next time something like this happens, an Occupy movement, or a boomlet for a charismatic figure, or an uprising across classes. That was the astonishing thing about the uprising here in 2011. I think progressives who have are in some leadership positions, and activists all across the board need to push us in a direction of maximizing our strength and building a continuing organization that will articulate our demands and force our demands ahead. I don't believe the left is dead by any stretch of the imagination. I look around. John mentioned a couple things that are great. The Black Lives Matter movement is a tremendously important movement. Here in Madison, Young, Gifted, and Black is a tremendous reflection of that movement and very important. The $15 an hour movement is a great movement that's taking over. I mean, who would have thought 3 years ago, 4 years ago, that people would have been demanding, you know, not just an increase of the minimum wage to $10.10, or what Mary Burke said should be $7.95 the first time around, but actually $15 an hour. And so that's kind of amazing. The 350.org movement to put the heat on corporations and then on universities that are investing in fossil fuel companies is an amazing thing that's going on across the country, thanks largely to Bill McKibben and an army of young people who are working on that issue. I don't know why it hasn't taken off here at the University of Wisconsin. It ought to. So that's also very exciting. I think we need to recognize the gains that we've made. We've had a nonviolent, peaceful revolution over the last 50 years of amazing power to give gays and lesbians their equal rights. That's been a huge victory. Legalizing marijuana is coming right around the bend. It may not come here to Madison or to Wisconsin, but it's coming in state after state. And so there's a lot of things going on, but really, I guess the one place where I differ maybe with John is just, I think there's some enduring issues, regardless of the technology revolution. And those enduring issues are we going to be a democracy or are we not going to be a democracy? Are we going to have war or are we going to have peace? Are we going to be an empire or are we going to be a democracy? Are we going to have nuclear weapons around that are going to blow the world up? Are we going to get rid of the nuclear weapons? Are we going to have an environment that we protect and that can endure? And so we've got to get at that in many different ways. I mean, I do think the jobless economy is coming, and what John didn't say is that he and Robert McChesney have a book coming out, a great book that I've been privileged to read a few chapters of, just on this issue. It's jobless economy, citizenless democracy. It's going to be a really important book that's coming out when, John, the fall?
No, it'd probably be right at the end of the year.
Okay. But John and Bob also say, you know, these are the eternal questions also. You know, democracy, we need to talk about economic democracy and not just formal political democracy. It's a joke of a democracy, as Ed Garvey said right now. I mean, to believe that we're in a democracy right now, you got to be kidding yourself. Yes, we get to vote every 2 years and every 4 years, but, you know, when the billionaires and the corporations can spend as much money as they possibly want to because of the Citizens United decision and the McCutcheon decision, the idea that you have the same voice and vote as one of the Koch brothers, I mean, it's just laughable. And people understand that. And when I read some selections from the Citizens United decisions when I give talks where they say, you know, letting corporations spend unlimited amounts of money won't lead to corruption, and that's what they say in there, and won't lead people to become cynical about our democracy. I mean, you got to ask yourself, what planet were those justices living on? And so the other exciting pro-democracy movement that is out there is this movement, and John was talking about amending the Constitution, the 28th Amendment movement, the Move to Amend movement. And here in Wisconsin, in 57 villages, towns, cities, and counties, 58? 58.
Which one?
There you go.
Dan Cabot's for Ellington.
So people or their elected representatives have passed by overwhelming margins, you know, 68%, 75%, 81%. A referendum saying that we want to overturn Citizens United, we want to amend the Constitution, we want to say once and for all that corporations aren't persons and money isn't speech. And this is one of the fundamental things we need to do if we're going to have a chance at democracy. So I'll just leave it at that.
Now comments from the panel.
My sense, and it goes with what everybody else says, my sense is that there is nothing new about the moment we're in. I don't think that I see nothing new at all. What we have is a situation where the monopolies, we have monopolies now that are bigger than we had 100 years ago. The only thing is that they're so much smarter than 100 years ago. 100 years ago, our monopolies were run by big, fat, white guys who, you know, kind of were really mean and turned machine guns on people and made children work. Now, they're run by women who write books called Lean Forward or Lean In. And they are, you know, much nicer. And they say, don't be evil and all that. But the fact of the matter is that we live in an age where our future is being absolutely monopolized by a handful of corporations. And they are more powerful than ever. And so I happen to think that the only thing we really have to adjust is our target, right? We have spent so much time worrying about, you know, organizing people and, you know, maybe depending on where your politics is, beating Republicans and stuff, all, you know, legit stuff. But I think that when you talk about young people, right, they actually know how much power rests with some very big institutions. I was at an event in Germany last summer, and it was a very elite event with a lot of corporate people, and then a lot of people from WikiLeaks and all sorts of stuff like that. And the guy from Google got up, you know, Google Europe, and boy, did he look great. Better suit than any of us will ever wear, great haircut, fabulous, and very hip. I am sure he is pro-choice, you know, no doubt about that. And I expect he was really, really good on gay rights, right? But what was fascinating is one of the guys from WikiLeaks, who's really worked a lot of this turf, got up and he said in the middle of the thing, you know, we're talking about all the stuff we got to do. I think we need to destroy you. And, you know, kind of gasp in the room. And he said, no, nothing should be as big as Google, period. Nothing should be as big and central as Google. And the fact of the matter is, until we start to think politically about stuff like that, because those are the organizing premises. Google is the Standard Oil of our time. You know, these are the Rockefellers of our time. And yet, so often we are still busy talking about Ted Cruz. You know, and it's fine to talk about Ted Cruz, but the fact of the matter is, Ted Cruz will never, ever have the power over our lives that a handful of technology companies have today.
But when you talk about John, the way the big corporations these days wear a different outfit.
They look
when
so
they
much
come
nicer.
To see, they do look nicer. I mean, a specific example of that was back when I was Attorney General for Wisconsin. There was an expansion of the Oak Creek Power Plant, which is one of the largest coal plants in the United States. And it is operating under standards which were set more than two decades ago. And since then, all sorts of things happened, including the Bush administration actually coming down on it for polluting too much, which we in the state of Wisconsin couldn't garner the muster at the time to do ourselves. But that being said, I tried to work around that limitation, but that being said, one of the things that I did at the time was to reach out to private nonprofit organizations thinking, there must be somebody out there who cares about the air we're breathing and all this crap that's being emitted from the Oak Creek Power Plant. And so I went first to the Wisconsin chapter of the American Lung Association. And I walked into its office in Waukesha County, just off the freeway. And the first thing I saw was the wall of donors. That was there, and with little plaques plaques and more plaques to all these wonderful people who had given the Wisconsin chapter of the American Lung Association money. And at the top, the biggest plaque, is in appreciation to Wisconsin Energy, We Energy, so the owners of the Oak Creek Power Plant. And I thought, well, this will be an interesting meeting. And indeed, the very well-dressed woman, I doubt she had a Google-level suit, but she certainly had a Michael Best and Friedrich-level suit.
She was
very proper, and she kindly explained to me that they were focused on clean indoor air. Okay, but I mean, and so in our little fishbowl of Wisconsin, this sort of thing goes on.
And it goes to, Matt, as you spoke about lost opportunities, we're at a want for leadership. And we're at a want for leadership in a way that could pull that together, and thought leadership. And even think about, we're all old enough to remember when university presidents were thought leaders. In their state and in across the nation. And we, because they too are now fundraisers, we are wanting for that. And in the progressive movement before, you had the circumstances in which independent thinkers emerged and people could gather behind that. But we don't have those circumstances unless we decide to create them. And I would say, and I say this speaking about myself, so I'm not throwing this at anyone, but myself and my experience. Certainly, as a baby boomer, I can tell you that we have habits of sucking all the oxygen out of the air and talking too much and not moving other people in position to lead when we should.
In the last 3.5 months since I moved over to the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign, I have been thrilled to meet a lot of young people who are between the ages, I want to say, of 25 and 35 maybe, who are working in the pro-democracy nonprofit sector. And Peg has been at some of these meetings too and some of these press conferences. These people are tremendously dedicated, very smart, really savvy, and it gives me hope that things are moving in the right direction. Plus, everyone's working together, and that's a very positive thing.
When Barack Obama first ran, I really didn't support him initially because I'm suspicious of charisma. But one thing that sort of brought me around and I thought gave me some hope is one of the things he said during the campaign, which I fundamentally really believe and I think is terribly important to remember. He said, lasting change comes from the bottom up, and we're the bottom. And I really want to thank the panel tonight for a wonderful conversation.
Thank you, Charlie.
You've been listening to a panel discussion of notable Wisconsin progressives in What's Left? Reflections on the Decline of the Progressive Party, sponsored by the Madison Institute, a policy study center in the progressive tradition. Panelists include Ed Garvey, attorney and founder of the annual Fighting Bob Fest, John Nichols, editor of The Nation magazine, Barbara Lawton, former Lieutenant Governor of Wisconsin, Peg Lautenschlager, former Attorney General of Wisconsin, and Matt Rothschild, Director of the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign. The talk was moderated by Charlie Upoff, board member of the Madison Institute. For more thought-provoking programs, go to the Madison Institute's website at themadisoninstitute.org. The views expressed here are those of the speakers and not necessarily those of the Madison Institute.